Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and the good folks at WKAR Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, interim director for the Institute, and I'm joined as always by MSU economist Dr. Charlie Ballard, who directs our State of the State survey. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks, Arnold. Good to see you again.
Later on, we'll be joined by Dr. Doug Bissett, an assistant professor for energy systems in MSU's Department of Community Sustainability, and Dr. Grant Gunn, an assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Sciences. They'll be discussing ongoing research and fieldwork pertaining to Line 5, the oil and gas pipeline that runs under Michigan's Straits of Mackinac. But before we get to the good doctors, Charlie, let's chat a bit about Michigan politics and policy. Since our last broadcast, the governor finally had an opportunity to give her State of the State speech. Legislative Republicans have also come out with their priorities. And no surprise to anyone, of course, at the top of that list are the condition of our roads.
Yes.
And funding additional road repairs. The governor also talked about free community college tuition. House Republicans, the speaker in particular, has made mention of ensuring that all of the taxes paid on gasoline goes to fix the roads, and so that would mean moving the sales tax money that is currently dedicated to schools and local governments to roads. A lot of good plans, a lot of good ideas out there by both sides of the aisle, all of which take money. And some folks have expressed a reticence about spending new money. And I thought it'd be a good idea. You know, I saw you recently give a presentation at the Michigan Society of Association Executives that again reminded me of Michigan's checkbook reality. So can you chat with us for a minute about that?
Yeah, we in Michigan have really for decades, we've gone down the road of tax cuts, sometimes explicit tax cuts, like the reduction in business taxes 8 years ago. But a lot of what's happened is not an explicit tax, but it's just that our tax system doesn't keep up with the economy. For instance, the sales tax only applies to about 3/8 of the things that are sold in Michigan. It used to be well over half, but the things that are taxed have been growing less rapidly than the things that aren't taxed. So even if you keep the rate at 6%, less revenue comes in. So the fraction of our economy that it goes to state and local taxes has shrunk quite dramatically. We're now substantially below the national average in state and local taxes. An awful lot of our problems in terms of paving the roads, paying for schools, all the other things that the public sector does, it's a combination of two things. Our economy hasn't grown very fast, so the tax base hasn't grown as fast as you'd hope. But the fraction of that potential tax base that we tax has gone down. So we are billions below the national average. If we taxed ourselves at the national average, we'd be bringing in several billions more. My number one tax policy statement in the current environment would be, first rule of holes. If you're in a hole and you don't want to stay in a hole, stop digging. And that means please, please don't cut taxes further. And the one place where that's really important is that Gretchen Whitmer and Bill Schuette both campaigned to roll back the taxation of retirement income.
So-called pension tax.
The so-called pension tax to where it was before 2011, 2012. Back in those days, 95% of Michigan seniors paid no taxes, and on net, Michigan seniors paid less than nothing because they wouldn't pay any explicit taxes, and then they would receive the homestead property tax credit. My colleague in the Department of Economics at MSU, Paul Menschik, calculated that back under the old regime, the average tax rate for non-seniors in the income tax in Michigan was 3.3%. The average tax rate for seniors was minus 3.4%.
Wow.
So that if we revert to where we were before, we will dig the hole by an additional more than $300 million a year. And then if you're going to If you start by making your hole deeper, then you've got to do something even to get back to where you were. So I really hope that we don't go that route just because it would dig the hole deeper. Also because the damage to our revenue system over time becomes bigger and bigger because our population is getting older. And then finally, as just a moral issue, my wife and I are going to retire sometime in the next, I don't know, 5-6 years probably. And if we go back to the way the law was a decade ago, we'll pay less income tax than our handyman.
Well, I like to think of it as a social responsibility issue for people such as yourself and even me, who over the coming years will eventually retire. I've always felt that I continue to have a social responsibility to help fund the education of children in the K-12 system.
Even though your children and mine are no longer
gone.
Yeah,
right. They're out of the system.
No, I just don't think that citizenship ends when you retire.
Right. And, you know, speaking of education, there was a report that came out just a couple of weeks ago that showed that, I guess you could say pound for pound over the years, Michigan now ranks 50th in terms of school funding, 50th. So now we're below that level we've talked about over the years about Mississippi and Louisiana and all of those states that people have said they don't want us to be compared to.
Professor David Artson in MSU's College of Education and some of his co-authors put out that study showing that our education funding has gone for K through 12 has dropped substantially in the last couple of decades. And I don't think that's a great outcome, but it's a natural outcome of our not fast-growing economy, plus our obsession with tax cuts.
That's right. Well, and during the Snyder administration, the legislature approved a $1.2 billion business tax cut.
Right.
Even though, and I've heard you say, our economy here in this state, and I've heard others say, is pretty much running a full tilt right now. Low unemployment, and yet our per capita income is, I believe you've noted, somewhere in the 30s in the country, where, as in the past, I think as Michigan's economy developed the middle class and our economy was running full tilt, our per capita income was known to be in the top 10. So here we are in a basically full economy. And we're not even in the top half of per capita income, which also impacts tax collections, right?
Of course, right. So it's a combination of our manufacturing-based economy has not grown as rapidly as the economies of other states, and the factoids that I like to emphasize. Back 50 years ago, you really could just get out of high school and, in many cases, literally walk across the street to an auto plant, make upper middle class wages and benefits. That was great. I'm proud of that. In a sense, Michigan invented the middle class. But things have changed in ways that simple repetitive tasks in a factory have almost completely disappeared. And so even factory work requires the ability to program computers and to do more sophisticated systems analysis. And thus, 50 years ago, when we were below the national average in educational attainment, it didn't hurt us.
Right.
Now we remain below the national average in all sorts of measures of educational attainment, and it does hurt us, and we need to do better along those lines.
Yeah.
Especially since, as you say, we're now at the peak of the business cycle. We don't know when the next recession will come, but eventually it's almost certain to come. And since we are still, even after all the shrinkage, we are still relatively heavily dependent on durable goods manufacturing, we know that you can't put off going to the grocery store, but you can put off buying a new car. Thus, durable goods manufacturing has bigger cycles up and down. And so whenever the next recession comes, it will be difficult. And that will put even further pressure on tax revenues and our ability to invest in infrastructure and in education. So it's really, in my view, very unfortunate that during this several good years that we've had, that we haven't done more to address these long-term issues.
Yeah, so I'd like to just put some facts out for our listeners and really give some substance to what Charlie is talking about. I mean, when you look at median household income adjusted for inflation from 1999 to 2017, Michigan's median household income is 15% smaller. As I noted, we're 31st in terms of per capita income. When you look at the amount of taxes, the fraction of our economy that's devoted to state and local taxes were at the national average, we'd actually have an additional $3.5 billion more per year in tax revenues. So the plans to fix the roads, improve education, keep taxes low is going to come crashing to a head here, I think. It's going to be very interesting to see how the governor's budget tries to address these kinds of issues. A lot of goals out there. There's a lot of things we need to do, as you've noted. We know from the research that those cities and states that have the highest percentage of college-educated graduates or those with post-secondary certificates have the highest per capita income.
Absolutely.
And although we're moving forward in that area here in Michigan, as noted by the release of a recent report, we've got a long way to go. And everyone across the country is doing the same.
Right.
You know, there's nothing unusual to these strategies that others aren't trying to do as well. And quite frankly, because of what you've noted about our dependence on durable goods over the years, the fact that our economy was more based on brawn than brains in the last half century, we're starting from behind.
Yes. Now, I will mention something that I learned only recently. I've emphasized many a time that we're below the national average in the percentage of our adult population who have a bachelor's degree or more. It turns out that we're not so far behind in terms of people who have some college. But having some college and not finishing a degree is not the ticket to right. prosperity. And we in Michigan have, unfortunately, a larger fraction than many states who have started college but never finished. And there are many responsibilities from that. One is K through 12 system to prepare students for college better, but some of it falls on the universities themselves. And I'm going to give a shout out to MSU, all the efforts that we are making to improve our advising, to change the schedules for students, to improve student health, because if you get pneumonia and you lose a semester, that can really throw you off. Completion grants. We've got a few hundred every year who, if we could get them through one more semester, they can finish, but they've completely run out of money. Give them a little bit of money, they can finish. And we have improved our graduation rates, and the biggest improvements are among the historically disadvantaged minority, low-income students, those who are first-generation college. So we've made some progress. I think we can serve as a model for some of the other universities, but it's a long-term challenge. But if we can get people to finish that degree, that's a ticket to prosperity much greater than if you just start college and don't get a degree.
Well, I do think it is going to take a extra effort on the part of universities and community colleges to figure out why it is that students who start don't finish. From personal experience, I sit on the Capital Area College Access Network Board here in this region, and some of the figures that we've seen over the last couple of years of students that start from this region at LCC or Michigan State University and don't finish is rather stark. And we're trying to figure it all out. I mean, here in this region, we've started the Lansing Promise, much similar to the Kalamazoo Promise. So I think we're starting to put the tools in place to incent students to get that post-secondary education. Now we need to figure out and apply programs at the university and community college level to ensure that they do finish, because it is important.
We have made progress, mm-hmm. substantial progress, but it's a marathon, not a sprint. And
exactly.
this is a challenge that we will face for decades. There's no quick fix. There's no magic bullet.
Well, given that reality check, now let's turn to Dr. Bissett and Dr. Gunn, who, as I noted at the top of the broadcast, are conducting ongoing research on Line 5, including public opinion surveys and fieldwork toward the development of strategies for preventing and clearing oil from the important and well-traveled Mackinac Straits. Their research is being supported by a grant from the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research through our Michigan Applied Public Policy Research Program that supports linking faculty research to informing the discussion on current public policy issues. Dr. Gunn, as the principal investigator for this interdisciplinary work, why don't you start us off with what your research is all about?
Sure. So our research in the Straits of Mackinac, they're twofold. We have a physical component and a social component, and I'll set the stage with kind of the physical work that we're doing, and then my co-ed Doug will talk about the social work that, not social work, social sciences that we're conducting. So in the Straits, there's Line 5 that runs from the Upper Peninsula to the Lower Peninsula, carries various crude or oil effluent, and there's been a lot of discussion as to what would happen if there were to be a rupture in that pipeline. And so there's been a lot of work by the Michigan Technological Research Institute as well as the University of Michigan to see what would happen in terms of flow and dispersion of the oil through Lake Michigan and Lake Huron if there were to be a rupture. They did a lot of that work in a ice-off scenario. So if this rupture were to happen from, say, late March through to late December. In an ice-on scenario is where that work hasn't been done. And so we're really interested to know if there was a rupture in Line 5 during an ice-on scenario in a consolidated ice flow, what would happen?
So this is, you guys are doing some groundbreaking research here then.
We're attempting it.
So this is what happens if the rupture were to happen at this time of the year.
At this time of the year, absolutely.
Yes, in February or...
Yeah. So a lot of the... I'll use this year as an example. We had a pretty poor winter in terms of ice development at the beginning of the year. So December, early January. And then we had that polar vortex where a lot of ice formed in Lake Michigan as well as in situ in the Straits. What happens up in the Straits of Mackinac is there's a great deal of oscillation and flow, reports of up to 2 meters per second in that area. So what happens is all this ice from Lake Michigan ends up getting transported by large flow processes up to the Straits of Mackinac, where it kind of channels and creates like a funnel. And then it funnels into the western side of the Mackinac Bridge, which is where Line 5 is. So there's a lot of ice in that small little area, and then the bridge acts as a cheese grater, and then pushes all that ice off into Lake Huron.
So when the ice hits the bridge's pillars, concrete and steel pillars, it kind of breaks it up and then keeps moving it on.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the question that we have, number one, is if the oil gets released and sits on the underside of the ice, number one, where does that oil go? Does it sit underneath the ice? Is there enough surface tension for that oil to actually adhere, let's say, to the ice, and then get moved into the Lake Huron? Or is it going to stay pretty much in situ, stay right there? Another question is, if the oil does move under the ice, does it get emulsified in the water? And then that complicates the cleanup. And so that we're attacking, looking at laboratory experiments. So a co-investigator, Dr. Vlad Tarabara, out of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, is conducting laboratory experiments to see, okay, what would actually happen in a high flow scenario if we were to release oil under the ice.
I mean, this is fascinating to me because A, you're dependent on the weather, right?
Absolutely.
Ice, and B, the experiment itself, I mean, you don't want to have an oil spill in the Straits at any point in time, let alone the winter, in order to do the experiment. So you just noted that these are actually lab experiments that are going on?
That's one component, is the laboratory experiments. And then the other component is actually getting out in the field and measuring roughness characteristics of the ice. So we actually are really concerned with the under-ice topography. So what the bottom of the ice looks like. Is it very undulated? Is it relatively smooth? Because a lot of experiments that have looked at oil under ice have to do with sea ice, which forms in a very different way than lake ice. So sea ice has these spires that, what they're called dendrites, come out from the bottom of the ice, and then they expand, and that forms a cohesive ice mm-hmm. layer. And that's very undulating. So if you have oil, it would, and it's high as a higher or a lower specific gravity than water, it would raise to the surface mm-hmm. and just rest underneath in those pockets. Lake ice forms pretty much as a cohesive surface, and it forms down from the surface.
So it's dense, and it's like a huge block under the water.
Absolutely.
None of these spaces for the oil to escape to or get into in order to make a cleanup easier.
As long as it's a consolidated ice flow, mm-hmm.
that's
true. But we're interested to know, what is the microtopography on the order of, you know, centimeters to a meter across multiple meters of distance? And so we're actually going out in the field. The Coast Guard is going to be taking us on either a cutter or a smaller ship. And they'll host us to actually bring some ice on the ship, as well as let us onto the ice to do in-situ experiments.
So this is great, because we've got an interdisciplinary project involving several folks across MSU, not just yourselves,
yep.
with the cooperation of the federal government then.
Yeah. So what they do, they support science activity at no cost, but they also take reporters, journalists on these ships as well. There's been a lot of interest in Line 5, so that's one of the concerns that the reporters would have, but there's also other, you know, shipping interests, economic interests. So the Coast Guard is very proactive in helping people access the straits, when they realize if we were to try to access the straits with our boats, there would be a lot more complication for them. So it's, you know, it's a win-win.
Right. And like I said, this is really, the work you're doing is kind of is groundbreaking work in terms mm-hmm. of trying to figure out what would happen in freshwater ice
yep.
If there was an oil spill. And of course, the issue of Line 5 has been with us now for the past couple of years. The legislature in December during the lame duck session moved through, along with the support of the governor, a deal to create a tunnel, I think is what we're calling it, Charlie, over the next few years to replace the pipeline. Mm-hmm. Still is some controversy. Doug, you want to talk a bit about some of the survey research that you've already done in this area and discuss attitudes of Michigan citizens on Line 5?
Sure. So what we wanted to do with the State of the State survey is examine Michigan residents' perceptions of the risk associated with Line 5. As Grant mentioned, there have been a number of studies that have looked at the technical risk associated with Line 5 spill, and have tried to examine the economic costs and the environmental damages associated with a spill. And to be sure, those are considerable. Some colleagues of ours, Robbie Richardson and a PhD student, Nate Brignone, looked at these damages and evaluated them as amounting to up to $6 billion in damage to the state of Michigan were a worst-case spill to occur. But there haven't been a lot of studies looking at the perceptions of risk associated with Line 5. And what we know about risk, particularly this type of risk, which is very low probability but very high consequence, is that people often have a lot of dread associated with that type of risk. And so we might see risk perceptions being much higher than we would expect from just the technical assessment. So we wanted to look at that with the State of the State survey. And I think what we found is not necessarily surprising, but I think it's important. So number one, we wanted to know, were people aware of Line 5? And we found that about 60% of Michigan residents were actually aware of Line 5, which people might think is not actually that much. But if you think about what Line 5, it's an invisible pipeline. It travels underneath the straits. When you're crossing the Mackinac Bridge, you don't know that the pipeline's there. There's no signs, you know, alerting you to its presence. So the fact that over half of Michigan residents are actually aware of Line 5, I think, is interesting. Of those people that are actually aware of Line 5, we found that about 70% of Michigan residents are either moderately or extremely concerned about a spill occurring. And so that's a lot of concern, and I think policymakers need to take that into account. The other thing, of course, we're doing with this research, and Grant spoke a lot about this, is looking at a spill under ice. So we wanted to look at people's risk perceptions with regard to a spill occurring under ice. And of course, what we hypothesized is that people would have higher risk perceptions of a spill under ice. And that's exactly what we found. So over 40% of Michigan residents reported being more concerned about a spill occurring under ice compared to a spill occurring in open waters. Mm-hmm. And only 18% were less concerned. And I think what's interesting about that is we see these really high levels of perceived risk, and yet we don't see a lot of communication. We don't see a lot of education about this either coming from the state or Enbridge or the Michigan Public Service Committee. We don't think about spills occurring under ice, and so I think that's what's really important and interesting about our work that we're doing.
Have we ever, we were talking about this a little bit beforehand, any known spills under ice that we're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of in terms of the spills under ice. Now, that's not to say that the Coast Guard hasn't thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
They've run several scenarios, and they just send out annual reports talking about their scenarios that they've run and the methods at which they have to remediate the areas, and whether that's skimmers or cutting a hole into the ice and letting the oil pool in there and then actually in situ burning that oil. There are methods at which they have to remediate it. That is to say, generally, these methods occur in the ice edge, mm-hmm. or in rubble fields. And rubble fields is exactly what it sounds like. It's a bunch of ice blocks that are about 1 meter to 2 meters in diameter there's many of them in one defined area.
Yeah.
So the oil would go in between these pans or these blocks. But what we're really interested in and what hasn't really been discussed very well is what happens if we have a really large pan, or what we would call a consolidated ice cover.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's no easy scenario or logistically simple scenario that we've seen to affect or to remediate that.
Now, Doug, you talked about awareness that you were able to survey through the State of the State survey research. Any questions asked regarding opinions on whether Line 5 should be shut down and replaced or just totally shut down? I mean, how did folks feel about that?
Yeah, so we definitely asked about that, and we found that a majority of Michigan residents actually do believe that we should shut Line 5 down and replace it. So over half of Michigan residents wanted to shut the pipeline down and replace it, while a quarter of Michigan residents urged that the pipeline should be permanently shut down. Now, we did see a distinction between how Republicans and Democrats feel about that. 47% of Democrats believe we should shut Line 5 down permanently and not replace it, while only 5% of Republicans supported that option. But the majority of both Democrats and Republicans believe that the Line 5 should be shut down and then replaced. Of course, the most likely result that we know is that the Line 5 is going to continue to operate for another 7 to 10 years, mm-hmm. while that replacement is being mm-hmm. built.
Yeah. Charlie, the straits there are very important to Michigan's economy, are they not? I mean, you know, you can go up Mackinac City or up to Mackinac Island for a day or two and see any number of freighters going through the straits. So if for whatever reason we had a spill, whether in open water or under ice, that would impact, that would have an economic impact, would it not?
Oh, it certainly would. And I think it would also have an impact over years that might be even bigger than the immediate effect, mm-hmm. because we in Michigan have quite rightly prided ourselves on having 1/5 of the world's fresh water. And that's one of the great things about being here, that you can see these beautiful lakes. You can swim in them. You can go to the beach. And if that were to be messed up by an oil spill, I think that would cause psychological damage that might take a very long time to deal with, although, of course, that's much more difficult to measure than the narrow economic damage.
And now the product that goes through Line 5, does any of that get used in Michigan, do we know?
So it's not entirely clear. So the pipeline begins in Superior, Wisconsin, and travels across Michigan underneath the states and then across the Lower Peninsula, eventually to Sarnia, Ontario. So there has been concern with Line 5 because a lot of the propane that's burned in the Upper Peninsula for home heating travels through the Line 5. Now that does not actually traverse through the Straits pipeline. That actually stays in the northern or in the Upper Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
But the oil that's refined in Sarnia certainly does come back into Michigan's economy, but it's not entirely clear how much.
And of course, the other point is, you know, and there's so many facets to this discussion, because the other point is that if you shut down Line 5 and don't replace it, that product is still going to get transported one way or another. And it could mean more trucks coming over the bridge and traveling on our roads. It could mean more tankers on our lake. So there's a lot here to think about moving forward. And I'm very grateful for the work that you guys are doing. And I'm looking forward to seeing, we'll have you on again when you've got some results from some of the experiments that you're conducting. I think it's going to be very, I don't think this debate's going away anytime soon. And so I think the work that you guys are doing are going to be very important to in forming that debate. Charlie, before we end, anything else to add?
Well, I think we have covered an awful lot of ground in a half an hour. It's always a pleasure to twist the tale of Michigan's economy and politics with you.
Well, thank you very much, Charlie. Always a pleasure to chat with you in this kind of a format. Again, my thanks to the both of you for the work that you're doing. I think it's a great example of IPSR's mission of supporting the work of faculty toward informing the public policy discussion. And as I noted, I'll look forward to having you both on again. Absolutely. Charlie, always a pleasure. As I mentioned, thank you. And thanks again to Russ Waite and the staff here at WKAR for their support of this program. Join us again next month on State of the State.